This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a new gold rush out west, and it's behind the latest controversy over the use of our public lands. This is the subject of a Frontline documentary that will be shown tonight on public television. My guest is correspondent Robert Krulwich. Over 3 million acres of federal lands are now in the hands of private mining companies. Under an 1872 law, mining companies get cheap access to the land and don't have to pay any royalties to the government for the precious metals they extract. The issue of royalties is now before Congress, and it's pitted Secretary of the Interior Bruce Babbitt against the mining industry. Last week, Babbitt reluctantly, under court order, transferred nearly 2,000 acres of federal land in Nevada to a Canadian mining company, American Barrick Resources. The company paid less than $10,000 for title to this land, which has an estimated $10 billion of gold. A federal judge ruled that this land belonged to the mining company under the 1872 Mining Act.
The act was created under President Ulysses Grant, and it was an unapologetic attempt to woo people from the crowded East into the empty West. And so it was, look, if you guys or ladies or family people come out here to the West, you too can be rich. We've set up a law that would encourage you to look around for silver or gold. Then, if you think you might find some, we'll let you lay claim very simply to the land. And if you then start digging holes and actually find something, we will let you, A, take the land from the people of the United States and make it yours for your family and your heirs and your assigns forever. That is, we will let you privatize public land for the purpose of mining. And B, when you take gold or silver out of the land, we will not charge you any royalty. It'll be all your gold. So come on out here and dig. That was the original impulse.
Well, why is this 1872 Mining Act still on the books, considering how much has changed in the American West and in America in general since the 1800s?
The miners, like the loggers and the ranchers, have political allies. And in this case, it's generally the congressional delegations from the Western states have been consistent for the last 80 years in making sure that any attempt by the U.S. Congress, and the attempts have been numerous and some of them ancient, you know, in the 1920s and the 30s and the 50s and 60s, again in the 70s with Cecil Andrews, people tried to change the law. But the senators and congressional delegations from those regions said, no, let's let the situation lie as is. And they were able to get enough support on other issues to keep any president of the United States, Nixon, Carter, right up to the present one, from changing the rules in any significant way.
In the meantime, there's something of a new gold rush happening now out west.
Yeah. A couple of things happened. First of all, the idea that most people have about gold mining, which is that, you know, once upon a time there were tunnels and you'd go to a river with a pan and you'd shake the pan and little nuggets would show up. I think most people figure that that's probably not the way big companies do it anymore. Probably people, like myself anyway, thought, well, what they'll do is they'll go into a mine, dig a hole, a channel into the mine and find some vein of gold in there and then probably get some robot or something to go in and take it out. That's what I thought. I was quite surprised by what actually happens. A few years ago, scientists, geologists discovered that there is gold in tiny, tiny concentrations, which can be magically segregated from regular earth. So if you walk along in Nevada, say, and you look at a big mountain or just a big space of earth, and it looks just has sagebrush on it, nothing in particular, and then you take a core sample and you send it to a laboratory and you see nothing. You see no stone, nothing shiny, nothing. But the microscope tells you that there's a concentration of gold in this earth of point something or other. If it's up high enough, like 0.9 or whatever, you throw up your hat just like old gold miners used to do. You yell Eureka, you jump up and down on the ground, of course, in a corporate sort of way, and your stock goes through the roof, as happened with American Barrick, and you're a very happy person. But still, you can't see anything. Then you dig a hole. A hole. The noun hole does not quite do justice to what actually happens. They get trucks that are so huge that the wheels of the trucks are like 15, 16 feet tall so that you have to reach up to touch the hubcap. And the trucks are unbelievably gigantic in how much earth they can carry. and you start to dig a hole or take the mountain down and then dig a hole underneath the mountain, and you move the mountain to large platforms, and then you spread earth, which is just normal, grungy, old earth with some vegetables and worms in it, and then you spread hoses across the top of the earth, and then you take a solution, which is a cyanide solution, and you drip it over the earth. And magically, you have a little liner down at the bottom. The cyanide solution percolates through the earth and attracts the gold, the tiny, tiny flakes of gold. And that all gathers on the lining, and you've got some mud at the bottom of the lining. It still doesn't look like gold, but then you put it in a large mill and you clean it, and in the end, it comes out as sparkling gold.
Well, you asked what I thought was a very clever question to a mining executive. You said, how much earth would you have to mine to get enough gold for your wedding ring? What did the guy tell
you? Yeah, he said that the trucks were going by. And again, imagine a truck bigger than any truck you could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a monster truck. It's going by. And that would not give me a fraction. All of the earth in there melted down to the gold would not give me a fraction of my wedding ring, which would seem to me hard to understand why this is a profitable business. However, the cost of the truck is huge, but the value of the gold is significant enough and has risen enough to justify the whole enterprise, more than justify, to make it quite a profitable enterprise. It's astonishing, really. I mean, if you're standing there and seeing something that big go by with less gold than is in a little piece of your ring, you think, this cannot be.
My guest is Robert Krulwich, correspondent for tonight's PBS Frontline documentary on the private use of public lands. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with journalist Robert Krulwich. One of the assumptions here is that mining public land for gold is a good thing for the country.
Yeah.
Because if it weren't a good thing for the country, then the government wouldn't be endorsing a policy that encouraged people to take public land and mine it.
Hmm.
What lies behind that assumption that mining public lands is good for the country?
Well, the assumption is the ancient assumption that we started with, the 120-year-old assumption, that the best thing about that's good for mining in the country is it brings people out west to settle the West. We don't really have that problem anymore.
Right.
The second assumption is a Bruce Babbitt assumption, which I think turned out equally false. He believed a few years ago that when he became the Interior Secretary, he would, like, wander around, say, in his mind anyway, a place like Las Vegas. And he'd say, well, who's here? Are these raw Westerners? No, a lot of them are Angelenos or people who come down from Salt Lake City or from Chicago who are croupiers and restaurant managers and golf landscape artists or whatever. And sure, they're Westerners now. Sure, they wear cowboy hats and cowboy boots. Sure, they are suspicious of Washington, like all good Westerners are. But do they really love miners? Do they really imagine themselves ranchers or loggers? Or could it be that really what they are environmentalists waiting to express themselves? And Bruce Babbitt was of the notion that if he and the President of the United States took a firm stand on timber and grazing and mining, that they would get a surprising amount of vocal support from Westerners all over the West, from Denverites, Las Veganites, Renoites, Boiseites, and so on. And that loud clamor of applause from all the people who want to spend the weekend hunting in the woods would scare the Western senators.
That's what
he thought. No way. Didn't happen. And it's a puzzle, I think, to both the environmentalists and to Bruce Babbitt. This new West, it's probably there. But what actually happened was when the timber issue came up and then the grazing issue, the people who felt their jobs were threatened, of course, went quickly into action and went back to the senators and the congressmen who were their friends and said, help us, and here's some money for your campaigns, and help us, help us, help us. And then the Babbitt side went to the environmental, to the quiet community and said, help us, and they didn't get much support. And the Western senators got traditional support, and the Western senators whooped Mr. Babbitt, and whoops, the president. They had a filibuster on grazing, which was quite successful. They beat back the various approaches that the early approaches that the administration had on those first two issues, and they're going to try to do the same thing here. Somehow or other, Bruce Babbitt has not yet been able to build the groundswell support. And of course, when he wasn't able to build it, the president of the United States, a very political animal, was just a wee bit worried about how this would affect more important priorities, the budget, health care, and the votes of those critical senators. He didn't want to offend them for his own reasons, and so Bruce Babbitt became, in several times in this story, a very isolated figure, with everybody bopping him and nobody holding his hand.
Mm-hmm. You know, part of the argument that the mining industry is making is, look, you need these jobs. You don't want to take these jobs away from people. Mm-hmm. But how many jobs are there now in the mining industry? From the way you described it before, it seems that a lot of the mining industry has become pretty automated.
There aren't that many jobs. And the companies that run, the headquarters of these companies are often in Canada and not in the United States. So they have a big problem. They don't have a lot of people who take, at least who work specifically for mining companies. Like any good lobbying organization, they point out that miners, A, use equipment, so you add in the equipment companies. That they drive trucks, so add in the truck companies. That they eat lunch, so you add in all the lunch companies. That they live in houses, so you add in the lumber companies and the construction companies. So you can build the case that this is a big industry with lots of jobs attached. But in the pristine sense of how many people go to work as miners or mining supervisors, it is a very small group. And that's compounded by the fact that many of these companies are run by foreign executives. So it's harder. They have a hard time. What is interesting to me, though, since this was the weakest link of the three, timber and grazing and mining, they are going into this battle willing to compromise, quite willing to pay some royalty, and quite willing to agree not to have to get the land for $2.50 or $5 anymore. But they're going into it more confidently than you would imagine, because they have noticed that when people, even a small group of people, find their jobs in jeopardy, they get the attention of their politicians. And governors and senators are alerted to their plight, and without any countervailing pressure from the broad swath of other people in the West, President Clinton, because he is a minority president, elected by a minority of the voters, and because he is very anxious to push agendas that would require the votes of these senators, is in a very weak position. And that's what gives them courage, Bill Clinton's weakness.
I think all the public land issues, as important as they are, they're not sexy issues to cover.
No.
And I think it's Dale Bumpers, the Arkansas senator who's been trying to reform the 1872 law, who mm-hmm. was talking to you in your documentary about the difficulty that he's had in interesting the media in this issue at all. Why did you take this on?
Oh, because I was real interested in Bruce Babbitt. Like everybody, I think I found holes in the ground kind of boring until I saw the holes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think, like a boy with trucks, I just couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. I just wanted to call up my son and say, Jesse, you've got to come here immediately because you have never seen anything like this. And I doubt whether my wife or my daughter, Nora, would be as interested. But there is a boys and trucks thing. And then there is the underlying tale, which is actually a good tale. I mean, even a fun tale. Which is called What Happens to This Region of the United States Now as It Begins to Fill Up? Mm-hmm. National Geographic did a neat job, I thought, when they took a valley in Idaho. And they looked up the valley, and up on the top of the valley there was a mine. And behind the mine there was some grazing cattle. And then down a bit were bunches of people riding skidoos in a skidoo trail of some kind. And then there was a river that was flowing along, and that had rafting people. And then kind of in the middle there was more cattle people and a couple of condo owners who were thinking of building a casino above a slag heap. And then down from them were some Hollywood people who had bought large ranches and didn't want the condo people building near them, didn't want the trail bike people. Then some hiking and fishing people were coming through up and down this group, up and down this territory in the summer. Here you've got a place that used to be empty, and now you've got all of these people bumping into each other. And this mining story, the logging story, and the ranching story is all a piece of that. But this is a space that is filling up, and Americans once again have to figure out by what rules and by what standards they will organize themselves and what are our priorities. And what's wonderfully interesting, somewhat stirring to me about Bruce Babbitt's attempt, as tough and as fruitless as it has been thus far, is to see a man who believes that you can get people to be reasonable and charitable in a situation which does not invite oftentimes either reason or charity. He believes that people will resolve this from down below.
Robert Krulwich, thank you a lot for talking with us.
Sure.
Robert Krulwich is the correspondent for the Frontline documentary, Public Lands, Private Profits. It will be shown tonight on PBS. This is Fresh Air.